So this is the fourth day of our four-day January retreat here in Tampa, the Franciscan Center, the lovely Franciscan Center. On walking the walk, treading the path of the Bodhisattva. Again, has been said in some of the discussions we've had and some of the questions, this weekend has just been an introduction. Oh, I didn't turn it on. He's back. So, as I was just saying, and some people have mentioned, there was a lot, doesn't sound right to say thrown at you this weekend, but it was quite a lot, both in terms of teachings and both in terms of meditation practices. You know, again, it's actually probably more traditional kind of the way this is than the kind of the way we do in the Sangha. I mean, in the Sangha, we have the advantage of, having our teacher here on a regular basis and meeting with our teacher and hearing regular teachings. That was often not the case. And oftentimes people would come together for a body of teaching and practice, and then they go off and practice it for a year or 6 months or 2 years. So oftentimes the transmission of the teachings and the practices and the meditations were done in a very concentrated way with the idea and the understanding, that this is something one would be working on for these practices and teachings quite a while. And even though, of course, we've taught Shantideva many times, and as some of you have been around for a number of years, so in terms of the four-point meditation and Tonglen and the sevenfold, all motherly beings, etc., etc., you've heard these teachings before. I think it's important to always weave them through again, because they are the basis of why we practice, or if they are not the basis of why we practice, the wise teachers in the past have known they need to call us to a higher calling in this life. Left to our own devices, we just muddle around in our self-cherishing. It is both to support us, but also to inspire us. And also, I think it's important that we weave in these teachings that are so heart-centered. Obviously, in Buddhism, liberation is ultimately and primarily found through the meditative side of life, through mindfulness, through concentration, through deep looking, insight, and ultimately both intellectually, analytically, as well as intuitively and directly understanding the nature of reality. But solely having a meditative approach to the Dharma can get a little removed and a little... it can lead one to be sort of above the fray, so to say. And so it's important that we weave with our teachings in one beautiful woven garment these teachings of the heart, these teachings that show us at the beginning, in the middle, and at the end. It is primarily about how we are with one another, and that the fruit of practice, the fruit of all that meditative practice, the fruit of all that study and understanding, is the great Zen master Dogen, the founder of Soto Zen in Japan, and considered, if you ever read his writings, an incredible, profound mind. He unsatisfied with the teachings of, of Zen and Buddhism in Japan at the time. He had gone to China to study. And I hope I'm not making this up, but to the best of my recollection at this moment, I believe when he returned to Japan and people asked him what he was bringing back with him, he said, a tender heart. That's quite profound. And I think it's what it all boils down to. So these wonderful teachings that have been transmitted to us by the masters, by the teachers, by the practitioners, for thousands of years, we need to take to heart and to practice them. And I think, a nice thing about the way this retreat has developed is there has been a nice balance between receiving teachings, but then in all the various meditation periods, going through a whole series of meditations, so one can begin to develop some direct experience of how to do them and to benefit them. Again, as was said yesterday, the other wonderful thing about these practices is we can take them with us. They are practices to not only take home with us and to work on the cushion and to reflect on, but as we go through life and as we constantly are interacting, constantly our habitual reference point for life, which is self, as it constantly tries to skew the conversation in its direction, that we have a way of seeing what's going on and understanding that what we're doing now is only reifying something that at its basis has no self-existence, but more than that, following that path of self-centeredness, self-cherishing. And please understand, a lot of people go, especially people who've come out of a background where there's been a lot of self-abnegation or self-hate, they think, well, aren't I supposed to, I'm learning to cherish myself. So please understand that this self-cherishing really is only cherishing myself. All I do is cherish myself. In the very least, as a bodhisattva, we want to cherish ourself and all others. There's a continuum. I cherish myself, so in other words, I am very careful in doing only what is good for me, and I am very dedicated to alleviating any sources of suffering in my life, but I am equally as concerned about treating others with great care and kindness, seeking their well-being, and certainly wanting to help in any way I can to ameliorate their suffering. So self-cherishing, you can use it as a good stand, to understand how to be with others. Because, from the point of view of self, all we care about is what? Our well-being, So if you are a very selfish person, and perhaps there are a number of us here today, and if you've always lived your life, thinking, what's in this for me, and, how can I advance myself and defend myself and protect myself and get my needs met and, get everything I want in life, right? So you have a good model there. And all you need to do is just extend it. That same intense desire for your own happiness, that same intense desire to relieve yourself of your own suffering, right? You see what I'm saying? All all the things, really what it's about, is all the things that we kind of naturally, in our self-delusion, wish for ourselves, we now wish for all beings. Right? So it's really kind of simple when you think about it that way. Just take all your complete, absolute selfishness and just kind of parcel it out to everyone. Right? And so we could say a bodhisattva is self includes everyone, so a bodhisattva is totally selfish. Because a bodhisattva's self is not just here. A bodhisattva's self is in everyone and everything. It is a self that includes all beings, all plants, all animals, all minerals. So it's okay to be selfish in that way. So... And again, that's the beauty of understanding. We know we don't have to kill anything. We don't have to destroy anything. We just have to understand and expand. So, I found a little verse. It summarizes things. And unfortunately, I don't have where I took it from. But I would imagine it must be somewhere in the Bodhisattva. It's kind of a... So it's again, as you see with Shantideva and a lot of, traditional Buddhists also, part of their education was in poetry. So you see in much of the various Asian Buddhist countries that a lot of beautiful teachings are written in stanzas, you know, like poetry, like verse. Inspire us to increase others' comfort and joy by thinking that others and we are no different. No one wishes even the slightest suffering, nor is ever content with the happiness he or she has. Inspire us to see that this chronic disease of self-cherishing is the cause giving rise to our unsought suffering, and thus begrudging it as what is to blame, destroy the monstrous demon of selfishness. Inspire us to see that the mind that cherishes our mothers, and of course here, as you now know, when you see reference to our mothers, you mean all motherly sentient beings. That's like a shorthand, all motherly sentient beings. Or for those of you who don't like that one, you go all children sentient beings. Either way. It means, inspire us to see that the mind that cherishes all sentient beings and would secure them in bliss and happiness is the gateway leading to infinite virtues. And thus to cherish these wandering beings more than our own lives, even should they loom up as our enemies. In brief, inspire us to develop the minds that understand the distinctions between, pay close attention now, the faults of infantile beings slaving for their selfish ends alone, and the virtues of the kings and queens of sages working solely for the sake of others. Inspire us to develop our minds so that we can understand that clear distinction between those infantile beings who spend their whole life slaving only to meet their own selfish ends and the virtues of the kings and queens, sages, working solely for the sake of others. So we've sort of come full circle to where we began the first night. I think the first night I made some reference to only two choices, right? Am I here for myself? Am I here for others? And at the end we get the same thing, a little stronger. It calls those who only consider themselves and only work for themselves and their ends are infantile beings. Infantile beings means what? Not grown up, not mature. And again, you know, it's interesting because we can certainly put enlightenment, bodhisattvas, buddhas, masters, you know, all this kind of stuff in very kind of hierarchical terms where somehow people who do come to realization of these matters are somehow extraordinary, right? But maybe that's really not the case. Maybe all they are what we are seeing is a real human being. Right? Somebody who has spent the time kind of getting rid of all the impurities. Right? That's all. It's not like they've added on anything special. You see, that we think they have something special. But it's really the opposite. They've gotten all the impurities out, right? And so their natural mind, their Buddha mind, their natural good heart can naturally just spontaneously come forth. So again, that is why when you have the opportunity of encountering great beings, you know, and again, you know, as years go on, centuries go on, you know, they take, you know, they become more kind of removed, right? Because their lives begin to get shrouded with myth, right? But when you meet perhaps the ones in the future who will be mythic, such as Thich Nhat Hanh, such as the Dalai Lama, what do you find? I mean, you know, you read them and you hear them and you are very impressed and moved by their great wisdom, by their understanding, you know, by their facility of the way they teach, etc., etc. But when you encounter them as human beings, what do you find? You know, a good human being. A nice human being, a kind human being, a humorous human being, a peaceful human being. You know, that is the wonder of it all. You know, when you meet it face to face, it is utterly ordinary, and yet utterly special. So, even though you know, again, we're talking about kings and queens, sages, but I think the better analogy is. Between grown-ups and children. And, you know, in children, right, those of you who remember being a child and those of you who've had the wonderful opportunity of raising children, you know, selfishness, self-centeredness seems to, you know, be very much what childhood is about, right? That kind of self-centeredness, meanness, when they're young, is very cute and endearing. When they're teenagers, it's not quite. but yet, as parents, we understand the developmental model, right? And we kind of work with that self-centeredness, that meanness, that selfishness of young children and old children. But at a certain point, we expect what? Time to grow up. Right? And one of the things we expect and hope for our children as they grow up is that self-centeredness, that meanness, that sense of personal entitlement, and that the whole world revolves around them, and they're just here to receive, will somehow diminish. And it's the hope of most parents that our children will grow up, right? And we see their growing up not only, you know, not only because they're now self-supporting, which is important, and, you know, in taking those kind of developmental steps of work and vocation and relationship and a capacity to, you know, be on their own, but I think more intrinsically, we want to see these qualities. We'd love to see these qualities developing in them, of becoming kind human beings and compassionate human beings, and understanding that life is about giving and not just receiving. So again, I think in a very human realm, we understand something about what maturity is about. And again, so I would just suggest to us that bodhisattvas are just mature beings. And actually, it's interesting as I say that, In a lot of the sutras, when it talks about the course of the bodhisattvas, their job is to mature beings. You know, the Buddha says, get out there and mature those beings, because they are very childlike. Right? They only want to what? Play. And have a good time. So the faults of infantile beings slaving for their selfish ends alone, the virtues of the kings and queens of sages working solely for the sake of others, and thus to be able to equalize and exchange our attitudes concerning others and ourselves. Since cherishing ourselves is the doorway to all torment. Is it all? I mean, I'm not making that up. You're looking at me. Please, you know, the wonderful thing about Dharma is it's not dogma. It's Dharma, not dogma. Which means, you know, when you hear things like that, you go, well, maybe that's true. Right? Maybe it's not true. Right? Maybe cherishing myself and only thinking in selfishness is the doorway to all happiness. Or at least sometimes happiness, sometimes torment. So check it out. And see where your self-centeredness gets you, and see where your altruism gets you, and you decide for yourself which is the better path. Since cherishing ourselves is the doorway to all torment, why cherishing our mothers, all sentient beings, is the foundation for everything good. Inspire us to make our core practice the meditation of exchanging others for ourselves. And again, the formal meditation of exchanging self and other, Tonglen, and all the black smoke and all that. I mean, that just gets it going. Right? You know, we need to get it going, and so that visualization is actually quite profound, I remember when I encountered, because again, it's counterintuitive, right? Because our thing is. No, my job is to cultivate within myself love and compassion and all these altruistic things and kind of wall off, you know, all that dark stuff, right? Because that dark stuff is what, right, brings me down, right? I mean, and all of a sudden we get this marvelous teaching that says what? No, there is a, you know, that taking in that dark stuff, you know, again, how do you take it in? Therapeutically. You take it in, you let it pass, you transform it, and you give it out. Please understand, this is not about taking that dark cloud in, you know, and living with it, right? If you're practicing that way, that's not the practice. But I think what that practice is saying is when you, because again, traditionally, I'm not sure the one that you've been doing here, but usually, when I was taught it, you begin that in your heart center is darkness. Is that that's the way you did it here? No. I'm glad we're having this conversation. I'm sure there are better ways than I was taught. But that you start out here. In my heart, it's hard and dark, okay? Which means what? It is the hardness and the darkness is self-cherishing, is ego clinging. All right, this is where I start out, right? And rather than just living in that, I look out, and what do I see? Another suffering or a whole realm of suffering, and what do I do? I take in, I'm open to acknowledging what they're experiencing, and then what do? I'm willing to take it in. And then in the traditional way, this miraculous thing happens, right? That when I take it in, this dark, sooty, yucky stuff, into my dark head's heart center, which is also dark, it opens, it softens, and all of a sudden it becomes light. And then, so then when I breathe out, you know, love, compassion, all virtue, all good things, you know, all, everything, and send it back to the person of suffering, what do? I see that because I have been open to another, right, and willing to take it in, I have cracked open my self-centered heart. I have cracked open my hard heart, right? And I find all of a sudden I have the capacity of what? Of helping another. And then usually after you've been doing exchanging for a while in the meditation, what happens, of course, is now your light and their light. Everybody's light. And then you just relax in that awareness of empty lightness. The world, for that moment, has been made pure. So, I mean, actually, I once asked my teacher, you know, Tibetans spend a lot of time doing rituals. They're always doing rituals. And what they say they're doing the rituals for is to kind of put all these positive energies, you know, into the world. And, you know, they all do kind of this stuff. And so I once asked my teacher, I said, you know, how come... You know, how come, you know, the world's such a mess? You know. He said, well, yeah, this is the problem, you see. We generate the stuff, we put it out there, you know, but 5 minutes later, you know, those sentient beings are just back to their old, you know, it's like, but it was interesting. What he said is, you know, but it is important because it's out there and it often manifests in sentient beings that in one moment, all of a sudden, they have this desire, or they respond to a situation with kindness or open with compassion. So he says, you'll see it that even in dark kind of human beings, sometimes momentarily, right? They kind of step out of character, and you go, wow, that was, you know, that was quite wonderful what they did. You say, well, that's what that is, but then. But then, you know, it's back to the old stuff. So there are two more things I want to talk to you about this morning. And the first is practice. We've been practicing a retreat, and now we will be leaving retreat. And this is when practice gets real. So I thought I would refer to, I think over the summer, I mailed out just to the members, and I don't know if anybody remembers getting this. Actually, the truth is I forgot about it too. But when I was looking through some stuff recently, I found it. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. I need to work on this again. So what I had done over the summer when I had some time was realizing for members who, you know, that over the years, with the retreats and the intensives and, you know, that lots of teachings and practices have been given out, as well as, you know, newer people coming into the community often kind of want to understand more clearly kind of our model of practice, not just our tradition, but actually our model. So I tried to put together the Florida Community Mindfulness Joyfully Guiding Sangha Care and Practice. This kind of guide, and I sent it out kind of unfinished, just more like an outline, and my idea was to write it up and really so it would be something that we could, you know, put on the website and give to all new members and make available. But I thought, you know, looking forward to our practice in reentering the world, that I could just talk about it a few minutes. So basically, And again, you know, with any kind of model, it's not absolute, and there are all kind of places where things overlap and interweave. But basically, I saw it as basically three major circles. And the first circle, or the first path, I called the mindful living circle. The second circle or path was the Buddha Dharma, and the third was the shunyata, or emptiness. And I called the mindful living circle cleaning the bowl, the Buddha Dharma circle pouring in the pure milk, and the shunyata circle as drinking deeply. And that again is kind of analogous to traditional Buddhist teaching. As you know, it is often said that when we come to the Dharma, our bowl is not clean. well, actually, it says it's more than that. You know, the idea there is, of course, the Dharma is this pure milk, right? Very nourishing and restorative. You know, and each of us as students, we are the bowl, you know, that is receiving the milk. But there are different kind of bowls. There are different kind of students. There are some bowls that are upside down, right? So the milk is poured and it just runs right on the bed. It doesn't even get in the bowl, right? There are other bowls that have lots of holes in them. So even though the milk is poured in, it immediately leaks out. There's basically no retention. Then there's another kind of bowl, which is a dirty bowl. A dirty bowl here means that the bowl that is being poured into is still just full of all of its own ideas, its own beliefs, its own judgments, its own projections, its own neuroses. You know, all the afflictions and delusions of self are present. You know, it's a dirty bowl. And so even though you're pouring this pure milk into it, the milk immediately gets what? Dirty. So traditionally, I mean, in the way I was thinking is, so the first thing we want to do when we enter practice is, you know, metaphorically clean the bowl, right? Clean the bowl. And that's kind of what I would see as the kind of the basis, the foundation of our practice. And here, in terms of teaching, obviously a primary one for us is the teaching of mindfulness, right? Learning to live in the present. Learning to know there's a present is maybe a big step. You know, there is a present moment. There is a here and now. And that one can learn to recognize it and live in it. And then secondly, I wrote mindful living. And for that, you know, all the wonderful teachings and traditions of that Thich Nhat Hanh has so elaborated over these last 20 or 30 years, you know, just all the aspects of mindful living. Another teaching, of course, which is related to that, is just engage Buddhism, the idea that, you know, this practice needs to be engaged in life. It's not something separate from life, but has to be involved with personal life, interpersonal life, family, community, etc. And then the fourth thing I added was self-healing, inner child work, learning to work with difficult mind states and emotions, you know, all that basic kind of stuff. And so those were kind of the teachings, and then the practices, at least for our community, you know, we do the Awakening to Light class, the Introduction to Mindfulness class. We're teaching people about sitting, walking, body, breath, mindfulness practice, teaching people deep relaxation, encouraging people to attend weekly meditation, days of mindfulness. We do the happiness intensive based on Thay's book, Happiness. So we have these kind of entry-level intensives to help people, and hopefully working with a mentor. So there's somebody working. And again, at this level, we have new members to our community, but I also would say that this is a lot of the people who come to our weekly Sangha, many of most which are not members. And so these are a lot of what the teachings and practices they'd be exposed to. And the books they'd be reading would be a lot of obvious Thay's book, Miracle of Mindfulness, Happiness, Reconciliation, etc. The books that deal a lot with emotional healing, like Radical Acceptance by Tara Brach, Emotional Alchemy, Joyfully Together, The Art of Building Harmonious Community. So, and again, that's not very elaborated, but that's kind of the ground, you know, cleaning the bowl. And, you know, that takes time. So people have some stability, some clarity, some capacity to be present, and have kind of used the practices and the teachings to do some significant self-healing. You know, so right away the message is, you know, we don't practice spiritual bypassing, as it's called. You know, we are not a wallpaper sangha. We acknowledge the cracks. We don't wallpaper them over. We acknowledge the cracks, and we want to fill them, before we start painting and wallpapering. Before we start building the building, we want to take care of the cracks in the foundation. Many of us have cracks in our psyche that have to be taken care of. So that's kind of the, I call the mindful living circle and the practices and teachings associated with it. So next is, this is a work in progress, is the Buddha Dharma circle, okay? Now, hopefully, the vessel is somewhat cleaned up, somewhat stabilized, and is ready to take in their bowl, the Dharma, the teachings. And here I've put down things like, we're at a Bodhisattva retreat. You know, I wrote down considering leading an altruistic life, considering walking a transformative path. And I think this is important because many people in the West have no idea about a spiritual path and what it is and how to walk it, and that transformation is possible and altruistic life is possible. So at this level, we're beginning to introduce the possibility that such a life is possible. And we're teaching things such as the four mind turnings, which that means, you know, basic teachings on impermanence and, et cetera. Four mind turnings, the impermanence of life, the preciousness of human life, suffering of human life, and the... Come on, some of you. What?
Nirvana.
No, not Nirvana. The four... Anyhow. But basically, suffering of human existence, impermanence, and... karma, the law and cause and effect. So, basically, fundamental Buddhist teachings that turn the mind in the direction of practice. Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, Three Marks of Existence, the Four Immeasurable Buddhist Teachings on Love, and introducing people just basically to the Bodhisattva Way and the Six Paramita. And at this point, where the practices, we're helping people develop now a meaningful daily practice. Okay, we're involving them more in breath meditation, calm abiding meditation, meditations from the Anapanasati Sutra, learning how to stop to breathe, etc. We're involving them in loving kindness and compassion meditations. Perhaps more analytical meditations, mind trainings, etc., beginning to condition the mind with some good dharma. And at this level, people at this level may be receiving the five mindfulness trainings and three refuges. They're beginning to involve themselves in the practice of sangha, perhaps they're beginning to attend intensives, coming to retreat, and now continuing to work with a mentor or maybe working with the teacher. Okay? And at this point, the readings would be like Thich Thai's book, The Heart of the Buddha's Teachings, or Consciousness at the Base. I don't know if you can change its terms. What's it called now? Understanding Our Mind now. It used to be called Breath by Breath. Books like that. Perhaps things like Shanti Deva's Bodhiyakara or Tara, the book Interbeing, introducing people to the trainings, the precepts of the Order of Interbeing, So now at this point, people are being more widely exposed to the teachings and practices of Buddhism and being supported in their daily practice of it. And then finally comes to the third circle, which I call the Shunyata circle, and called drinking deeply. So now the student is ready to really drink, not just hold the pure milk in the vessel, but to drink deeply of it. And this is again where we enter the teachings of Vipassana. Insight, Thay calls that the teachings of deep looking, where we look more deeply into the nature of self and nature of reality, really understanding what interbeing, interdependence, dependent arising, what these things really mean, not just intellectually, but through profound and deep meditation on it. And all of a sudden, the meditations and discussions begin to revolve around things like non-duality, emptiness, and non-self. And here again, the practices are investigating the mind, self-inquiry, relaxed awareness, space-giving, working closely with a teacher, attending seven-day retreats, doing solitary retreats. Okay. So this is the kind of level of practice. And at this level, the readings are things like the Heart Sutra, the Platform Sutra, the Diamond Sutra, the Vimalakirti Sutra, verses on the faith mind, another type of Zen and Dzogchen, great perfection kind of teachings that present Dharma at this most profound level. So that's the model. Again, I think it is a model that gives one a sense of developmentally how to proceed. It also may say, gee, I've only been at the second. I don't know if I really took care of the first. and oftentimes, that's a significant issue for people. Because there are many people, you've heard me say before, who want to practice Buddhism at level two, who want to practice Buddhism at level three, and yet are continually going up and sliding back, going up and sliding back, continually, having desire to practice deeper and yet always being ambushed by habit energy. And that, again, that's often because in the beginning we were so greedy. We just wanted to pour the milk in and drink it up. We never thought about taking the time to clean the bowl, taking the time to establish a strong foundation. So when the milk was poured in, we could hear it purely. And then when we went to drink it, it tasted wonderful and we were immediately nourished. So that's why you always hear me say, the first path, in a certain way, is the most important. I think, again, it's because the nature of, Westerners, we are highly impatient. We want it now. That is a fault. And secondly, I think many of the people who are attracted to Buddhism here in the West are somewhat intellectually sophisticated. So we get things more easily intellectually. So we think because we understand things intellectually, we can actually practice them. We can actually live them, but that is, again, not the case. So it's important that we not jump over this cleaning the bowl. Now, again, it doesn't mean that, I think what we're offering here is a model. If you have a brand new person, you have a very nice developmental model. This is what you do first. You work on this. You're working with a mentor, with a teacher, so there's somebody giving you feedback, holding up the mirror, helping you understand these teachings. You come to them with your practice, you come to them with your issues. They help you learn how to utilize Dharma. So I think the involvement of the mentor, the involvement of the teacher is key. There is nothing there is no craft, there is no profession that one enters of any significance, no musical instrument, no craft, where one doesn't need, I mean, especially if one, someone's come really proficient, where one doesn't need a mentor. Right? Somebody who not only shows us, but somebody who critiques our work. Right? We are grateful to people who critique our work if we want to get better. If we don't want to get better, we resent people who critique our work. Right? But if we want to get better at it, we say, please, critique. No, stop saying nice things about me. That doesn't help me. Right? Critique me. Because I want to be the best person I can be. Right? So when we involve ourselves with mentoring, when we involve with ourselves with teachers, we are wide open. Right? That's what they say, Zen, a little harsh, historically, and in some of the Asian countries, according to Thich Nhat Hanh, it wasn't that way in Vietnam, but we know in China and Japan, there was a kind of harshness to it. So you get statements, but again, I think they're meaningful, where they say, the 30 blows from the master are the kindest thing we can receive. Thank you. But again, I think the spirit of that is, we want our faults pointed out to us, right? Again, when you have a meaningful, heartfelt relationship with your teacher, you know your teacher is not pointing them out because he enjoys going around criticizing people and making them feel bad. He's doing it because of his love and the desire to help you get unstuck. And it's not easy to get unstuck. It's not easy to get outside of self, because self is all we know. Right? We see everything through the prism of self. So it's hard to see clearly, very hard. So we're very fortunate if we can have a teacher, a mentor, who's not just, it's nice to have niceness, it's nice to have kindness, but it's nice to hold somebody who just holds up the mirror. And we know, again, it's just another kind of parenting model, right? Sometimes we're nice and kind and just a lot of fun with our kids, and sometimes we have to be somewhat, tough love. Right? But we know that tough love is a kind of love. And so hopefully we do it not in anger, not in judgment, but because we want to help. So, any questions on what's just presented? Anything not clear, or any questions? Well, that's interesting. Good. I mean, you think it's a useful model, or you think it's a... Oh, okay, just want to make sure you didn't think it was the stupidest thing you've ever heard. Just were kind of, just being kind of kind to me. So as we move toward the end of retreat, I wanted to talk to something else. It's a little future based, but since everyone here is a member of our community, I think this is a good venue for me to talk about it, especially in relationship to the retreat, and I mean the subject matter of the retreat. And now I'm talking about the decision that was made by our board of directors to seek a more established, permanent, physical home for our community, and at this point in the Tampa area or Tampa Bay area, depending on how it works out. And at this point, after the board made the decision, there is a search committee that is actively looking at properties in the Tampa area, and as well as we have a capital campaign committee that is beginning to look at financial issues related to it. So there has been some good practical kind of discussions going on. And as I began to hear some of them early on, I got a little concerned, to be honest with you, because I was hearing a lot of good practical stuff, but I wasn't hearing a lot of Dharma. And so I want to take this opportunity to talk a little about Dharma. And again, I think it relates directly to what we've been doing this weekend. So as people who are walking the Bodhisattva path, as people who are understanding that I am not practicing for myself, I am practicing for others, I am not simply concerned about my own peace of mind, my own comfort level, my own spiritual practice, but my spiritual practice, Dharma practice, must be involved directly with beings who are suffering. And so this, begins just with very individual person kind of understanding that. And by the individual beginning to extend themselves beyond their own selfhood and beginning to extend themselves out to others in their desire to help and be present. But I think in the same way, as a community, of people as an organism, that also occurs. My sense of our community, it also has its development, right? It's organic development, and looking back, I can kind of see what happened. it began in my living room. It was very sweet. I used to talk with old Dharma friends who had been through the Dharma wars in various kinds of communities and centers and would kind of lord it over them with, this is wonderful, this is so easy. There's no power issues because there's no structure. It's great. I open my house once a week. People come and sit. They go home. So there's no structure. So there's no power issues. No money is being asked for anything. There's no charge for anything. So again, no issues around money. So it was all, this is really wonderful. I would say to them, I like this. This is easy. But, at a certain point, it began to grow, and it was kind of too many people for the house. But also, developmentally, it was, I realized it had become Fred's group. And I felt it was time for the people who were coming to take more responsibility, and I realized they never would. As long as it stayed the way it was. So at that point, we moved out into the community, into rented space, renting from various yoga studios, and this is sort of what's been happening. But looking back on those years, I would say the practice was very immature. And those of you who remember those days, we attracted all kinds of people. And there'd be issues that people would have. Because, again, I think it was just the practice was people had not been practicing long enough and deep enough and weren't really open to really bringing the Dharma into their life and really didn't understand what about working with a teacher. I mean, there were people who liked me to be their friend, who liked coming to my talks, but didn't like me holding up the mirror to them. They didn't think they needed that or wanted that. So I think for a number of years, it was growing, but it was a lot of coming and going. But I think fortunately, out of those years, a core developed. I think in the early years, there wasn't a significant core that could there'd be a counterweight to all the projections and neuroses of many of the people. But I think developmentally, that what happened during those years, a core developed of people who were sincere and committed, and so over the years, all of a sudden now there was something to hold. You know, there was a core. There was something now that could be built around. And so, good fortune over these years, I think, is that, we have developed as a community where there's a lot of solidity. And the solidity really comes from practice. You know, that we have a core of people now who have been practicing 10, 15 years, practicing together, going to intensives, going to retreat, practicing daily. Been involved in many different teachings and practices, gone to see practices with Thich Nhat Hanh, and I think have gotten it and have done significant healing and transformation in their lives. That at this point, I mean, to me, one of the significant things is that we, in a community of what, we're 125, 150 something, of members, I'm saying, that we have a core community of Order of Interbeing members of aspirants are 20 or 25. So that's a solid core. Right, of people who have stepped forward and made a formal commitment to the Bodhisattva path and to working for the Sangha. I would say equal to that, we have an equal number of people who aren't ordained in the Order of Interbeing, but really share a lot of the same commitment to practice and commitment to Sangha, as well as, we have another 50% of the Sangha that are practicing with us, and I think are very dedicated. So, the idea of taking a step to find our own place, I would have never considered a number of years ago. And again, not for financial reasons or all that, but just because my major concern is the maturity in the practice and that we really have something to transmit. And that's something to transmit is not just the practices. It's that the practices have been practiced and one knows them from the inside. Then one has something to transmit. I remember years ago, sometimes I get somebody call me up and say, hey, I hear you teach mindfulness, you teach Thich Nhat Hanh stuff. Can you come to our meditation? It could be some kind of, I don't know what kind of meditation group it was. Can you come and teach it? And I'd kind of go, well, I think I'm busy that. Well, they said, well, could you teach it to me and then I'll teach it to my group? You know, it was like, it was that kind of thing. It was like, oh, it's just like a thing, that you kind of, it's like Dharma for me is too precious to kind of bandy about in that way. And again, I don't see Dharma as a series of techniques that one just kind of reads about and memorizes. But there's something to be practiced. Because within every practice is a realization, and it's really the realization that needs to be transmitted along with the practice. And, so my feeling now is that we have a significant number of people who've had enough realization of the inner meaning of the practices and have brought them into their lives and have enough experience that they've cultivated their own wisdom and understanding of them and that can be transmitted. My understanding are actually considering finding a place of our own really arose more just from the kind of hassle of using other people's spaces and the spaces not being right and the changes that would go on with the ownership and size. And I mean, it just became at a certain point, maybe we should look at our own space. For lots of reasons. It kind of developed, and here we are. So I mean, I think that's kind of one stream that has led us to where we are. That at some point, just being a group of individuals who are a community that meet once a week does not really give a sense of stability and does not really offer to the community an ongoing way to relate to the teachings and practices, nor does it give us an opportunity to be very experimental and comprehensive in our presentation to the community. Now, why do we want to do that? Well, you know, we could do it because we want to be famous. Right? Or we could want to make some money. We could do it that. Or we could feel that, you know, within this this wonderful tradition that has been transmitted to us, there is great wisdom and knowledge and practical practicality that really meets the needs of our society. I don't need to tell you that. Our society has lost its way as a society. But even more intrinsically, the individuals of our society, many of them, have lost the capacity to be happy. Right? They don't know how to be happy. They don't know how to be at peace. They don't know how to be calm. They don't know how to love. Right? They don't know how to be patient. And because of that, great suffering is incurred, experienced, and transmitted to others, even to the ones they love and care about. So for me, and that's why I said, you know, I think this retreat is an opportunity to talk about it. For me, it's not about bricks and mortar, and it's not about money. It's about bodhicitta. And it's about, you know, are we ready to fulfill our vow to be of benefit to beings, to come, you know, when we started talking about this, a lot of people got uncomfortable. It's kind of nice the way we do it now. It's kind of easy. Not a lot, not too, you know, some responsibility, but not too much. Some work, but not too much. Some taking care of others, but not too much. It's kind of nice. Some financial commitment, but not too much. It's kind of nice. It's comfortable. It's kind of sweet. Right? Why don't we just stay where we are? There's only one answer to that. What? Because we're bodhisattvas. We're not here for any of that. We're not here for our own comfort. We're not here for our own sweetness. We'll exchange our sweetness. We'll give it to others. And we'll take on the difficulties. Right? Why? Because we're bodhisattvas. That's what we're here for. And so this is an opportunity to practice that and not just talk about it. You know, a kind of a side thing to that is, and something that always moved me, you know, it sort of, I think it sort of died out. But 10, 15 years ago, Thich Nhat Hanh was very interested in these mindfulness practice centers. And there was a few beginnings of that. A couple have remained, as far as I know. But the energy to really develop and support never took off. And it was kind of his vision. He's a visionary, so he sees things big. You know, but his idea was, you know, every town, every community should have a mindfulness practice center, a place that was open 24/7 where people could go, they could learn the practices of mindfulness, they could learn the practices of mindful living, they could learn the practices of deep listening and communication, where they would have an opportunity. It would be a peaceful place where people could come and be nourished, right? Come and be nourished. Nourished by presence, nourished by friendship, nourished by openness, and nourished by Dharma. And so, I mean, to me, if we do go ahead with this, I see that's kind of what we want to establish. That's sort of our model. Many of our members, we've talked about how wonderful if we could offer more, mindfulness in parenting, mindfulness in relationships, mindfulness in raising children, mindfulness in education, all mindfulness in stress reduction, all the various kinds of bridges to the community. To have a place allows us to do a lot more of that. So that's kind of another current for me contributes to this, again, what I'm saying, not only the fulfillment of our bodhisattva vow, I think it's a good organic development for our community, and that we have the ripeness and maturity. Anybody can buy a building. But again, the important thing is, since we want to offer to the community something of quality and depth, to me that is more important than, that whether we have a building or not. And then, to me, the final piece of this would be, we could do this together. We could do this together. We could work together to create something beautiful and wonderful for beings. And we could be happy and enjoy doing it together. It could be great fun. It could be. Well, I would hope you would think it would be. Samanta Bahadra, right? The Bodhisattva of joyful effort. He's happy doing these kinds of work. He's not burdened by them. Many of us over the years, especially if you've been in social services, if you've worked in nonprofits, you worked in all the organizations like that, schools, there's problems there. You're always having to deal with what? With other people, many of which who come from a different value system, don't share a common practice, right? You have to deal with bureaucracies, you have to deal with regulations, you have to deal with, So even though many of us work in these settings, oftentimes we are frustrated because we really can't manifest purely, the energy that is driving us, the values we're driving us, and be totally open in terms of our giving. I see something that we are creating as something where we can be, where it is possible to work together with like-minded people who share the same values, who have the same intentions, who share a common practice. So as problems as they always arrive when people are working together, you put a bunch of sentient beings together and it's just what? Opportunity for what? Ego, right. So it's a wonderful opportunity, especially after this weekend. Everybody knows the faults of self-cherishing, so that one's taken care of. I'm sure. We'll have maybe a room in there, faults of self-cherishing room. Andy, sounds like you need to go to the faults of self-cherishing room for an hour. Anyhow, so again, to me, in reflecting on that, I think this is an exciting thing to manifest the Dharma energy, the energy of the practice in a way that is, where we don't have to compromise. Again, living in the world and living in societies and involved in all kinds of other activities, oftentimes we have to compromise, and that's understandable. That's just the way it is. But how wonderful to be able to create something that's our own, where we don't have to compromise. We can be uncompromising. Right? The Buddha is uncompromising. The great masters are uncompromising. That's why they're masters. They're uncompromising. They know the truth, and they speak the truth, and they live this truth, and that's all that matters. They're not afraid. And so I certainly see that would be a wonderful manifestation of our contribution if this comes into being. So I wanted to share these few words with you since we don't often get a chance to get together like this, and because I think it's, I feel called upon because of the nature of this retreat. That again, this undertaking, for me at least, is only about bodhicitta. And hopefully, you know, it will be for everyone else. And if it's not, please look deeply into that. I mean, I got a little feedback. Some of the other sangha people in more distant areas are going, Tampa Bay, far away from me. How's it going to benefit me? You hear where this one's going. That's not the way bodhisattvas think. That's self-cherishing. As I was saying to somebody, you know, every year, at the end of the year, that's when I do my charitable giving. And as I give to all these various organizations financially, if I reflected on it, not one of them helped me. Not one of them helped me. Every one of them, whether they're in St. Petersburg, whether they're in America, whether they're in overseas, they're all, I mean, the whole idea of charity is what? You know, to give to others. I mean, it's like, I don't think, you know, well, I'm not going to give to this one. It doesn't benefit me. Hey, I'm not homeless. Right? Well, you know, why give to homeless people? You know? You know, I'm not a blind person in Tibet. Why give to Siva? You know what I mean? Why? You know, I mean, right? Right. But we do. But we don't think that way, right? So, you know, take joy in the joy of others. That's part of the practice. You know, you know, I'm not here to benefit others. I'm here to. I mean, I'm here to benefit. Slip of the tongue. Yeah, so again, it's important that we understand the, you know, that this is all about practice. If they're happy, I'm happy. Somebody else told me that some people go, in, like from the Naples area, might say, if there's a, now a center established up in Tampa Bay, that could mean that Fred may no longer be coming here every other week. But we don't know if that's true or not. But again, that's not the way to think. You know, I don't think about what benefits me. What's, you know? I mean, that's ego-centered. There's no dharma in that statement. And kindly, the mirror needs to be held up to people who think that way. Because they've missed a significant piece of what this practice is about. This is not about me. It's not about self-cherishing. It's about generosity. Then, you know, dana. We talk about dana. I don't know, have we done our dana talk yet? What?
No.
Oh.
Well,
so
look at me.
Oh, I don't know. I thought
the
I.
The answer is no.
Oh. Don't we usually talk about dana at some point?
Yeah, we actually did going to.
Oh, when? When do you do it?
I don't know. Who's got the schedule? Probably.
Oh. Doing it, but I
well, maybe this afternoon after the retreat would be good time. Anyhow, you know, dana is generosity. It's about, it's a spirit of generosity. It means I don't distinguish between myself and others, the needs of myself and the needs of others, so I give. I give what? I give everything. Right? I give my time, I give my money, I give my energy, I give, you know, whatever it is. You know, it just, it's here to be given away. Dana is not like a thing, you know. I mean, that's what I was saying, because I mentioned the dana, you know, not to make a plea for dana, but I mean just because, you know that given money for retreat or something is like just one, that's just, that's an application of something that's deeper. Dana is one of the paramitas of a bodhisattva. It's the spirit of generosity. The spirit of generosity is non-self. Right? When there's no self, there's no self to hold on to anything. When there's no self-cherishing, you know, it's not about how can I keep it all here for me. You know, I want it out there. Right? You know, I give money to teachers who I never see anymore. Right? Because I love them and I respect them and I'm happy wherever they are that they're helping sentient beings. So I support them. I don't think about, well, gee, I haven't seen them in years, why should I? You know, they're not benefiting me anymore. I mean, that's a very narrow, immature way of thinking. Right? And we have to make sure that we are a bodhisattva sangha, not a hinayana sangha, not a self-cherishing sangha. That's not our teaching. It's not our practice. So, again, it's everything. And if we go ahead and find a place for ourselves and create a home for our community, it should all be done in the spirit of bodhicitta. And it should only manifest the spirit of bodhicitta. And if it doesn't, we shouldn't do it. You know, this is not about franchise. You know, we're not opening up a McDonald's franchise, a mindfulness franchise. Let's get in on the business. It's not about that. So, on that note, I just wanted to read one last line and then we'll stop and have our closing ceremony. Just two verses from Shantideva. All the joy the world contains has come through wishing happiness for others. All the misery the world contains has come through wanting pleasure for oneself. Is there any need for lengthy explanation? Childish beings look out for themselves. Buddhas labor for the good of others. See the difference that divides them. So that's the final word on this walking the walk, treading the path of the bodhisattva. Please take these teachings and practices home with you, but most importantly, establish them in your heart. That's where they belong. And you will be happy.